You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In honor of this being the last season of the podcast, I wanted to share an episode from the backlog. I recorded this episode about 3 years ago before I remembered to confirm Slack notifications were turned off before recording. So, you will hear a few Slack notifications. In this episode, I speak with Michelle Ronson.
I'm a classically trained designer, so I had been designing for years and kind of worked my way up through the ranks on the design side to lead large design teams as a design director for both Bank of America and Wells Fargo for a combined 13 years. And I absolutely loved what I was doing. But after a certain period of time of both leading teams and designing and teaching design, I just wasn't as excited as I had been earlier. And I went back to school at the California College of the Arts, and I participated in their inaugural innovation fellowship program. And that was the first time I had ever conducted research myself. I had worked with a lot of researchers. I had acted on a lot of research. But when it came time for me to actually gather feedback myself, I like to say I fell down the rabbit hole like Alice in Wonderland. And I decided right then and there, that's what I wanted to do next.
Michelle will be talking to us about how early researchers can build their confidence and define their careers. So we have to go back to when you said that you were classically trained as a designer. What does that mean to be classically trained, especially in the UX space where we have so many different backgrounds? So what do you mean by classically trained?
I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts. And back then it was in graphic design. And then I worked my way up, you know, through the ranks from graphic designer to art director to creative director to design director. And as the world of digital everything evolved, so did what we were designing. So started off doing a lot of print work, and then that evolved as the technology evolved into a lot of digital interfaces, everything from ATM screen interfaces to intranets to standalone websites for different types of campaigns within the organizations, digital assets, worked on everything from the Olympics to, I mean, you name it, all businesses within financial services, from wholesale to retail to investment banking and so forth.
So you started off as a designer, and then you mentioned that when you were a part of that inaugural cohort, that's when you had to do research for the first time, right? So how in the world did you go from being a designer to being a researcher to deciding to educate other researchers at this point? At which point in your career did you pivot from doing research to actually educating other researchers?
Great question. So I've always been an educator. I come from a family of innovators and educators. And I started to teach literally the day after I graduated from art school. My art school had a high school experience program. And I began to teach the high school kids in the summers after I graduated. And then eventually, this was on the design side. And then eventually I transitioned from teaching the high school students to teaching the undergrads, and from teaching the undergrads to teaching the master's students. And then I moved around to a lot of different universities, all at the design, on the design side. When I went back to school at the California College of the Arts, and I had that Alice in Wonderland experience, I had still been teaching on the design side, you know, for 15 years at that point. The year after I began to teach in that program at CCA, and then I later taught in their undergraduate program, design research and methods and things like that, and then in their master's program too. And then that led to teaching at UC Berkeley and teaching at General Assembly also. So teaching's always been a part of my career. I've always loved it, and I hope to always do it. It's a great way to really become invested in your subject matter and invest in people that want to grow in those ways as well.
So it's natural to see how you got from that point to Ask Like a Pro. So how did Ask Like a Pro begin?
So this is a great, this is a really good story. So by the time I got to General Assembly, this was the first time in my entire teaching career I had taught in a non-matriculated environment, meaning that anybody could sign up to take my classes at General Assembly. They were elective. They weren't required to take it as part of a certificate or a degree program. And for clarity, I do not teach in the General Assembly boot camp, the UX design. I teach in the standalone workshops. So I had all walks of people taking my classes. I had people that were dental hygienists. I had insurance agents. I had superintendents. I had designers, product managers, entrepreneurs. I had gardeners. And I mean, you name it. And I was fascinated by this. I was fascinated by all the different types of people that were interested in this subject matter, that were investing their own time and money to learn more about this. And they began to ask for more and more classes. And at the same time, my corporate clients began to ask me to teach them how to do what I do, or to teach their teams how to do what I do, which is, you know, user research or design research. And eventually I went to General Assembly and I asked if I can build out a user research certificate program for them, because there were a lot of requests. And they said, no, I couldn't do that because they didn't want anything to compete with their UX design certificate program. And I was like, no, this is totally different. This is it won't compete. And they said, no dice. It wasn't about me per se. It was about any other, you know, certificate program. They saw it as sort of a conflict of interest. But I have a great relationship with General Assembly. I still teach there. And they said that they would fully support any new user research classes I wanted to offer. I just couldn't offer them in a series per se, and definitely not in a certificate program. So I added more and more classes to the mix. And one class was called Mixed Methods, where the students went through 9 different methods in one day. And because I never knew who was going to sign up for my classes, the only thing they had in common, or the only thing that I knew, was that they all wanted to learn how to ask better questions. So I needed one umbrella subject to tie this all together, to tie the 9 methods together that they would go through in one day. And the most obvious one to me was, how might we educate the next generation of user researchers? How might we grow the existing generation of user researchers who want to get to the next level? So this was the unifying theme for the entire day-long mixed methods workshop. And that's what it was. It was a workshop. And 70 people took this workshop. And there were some very, very distinct themes and patterns and pain points and opportunity spaces. And as you know, this is way more research than you would do for a typical client, but it wasn't research to me. To me, it was a fun class and it was a unifying umbrella. So I went back to General Assembly and I said, look, I've just, you know, run this class. We've put 70 people through it. Before I had a hunch, but now there's a real gap. There's a pain point. Here are the themes. Here are the opportunities. This is what they're thinking. This is what they're saying. This is what they're doing, etc. And they still said, no dice, can't do it. So I tossed and turned about it for a couple of months. And finally, I just said, self, you know what? You're in a very unique position to do something about this, to fill a small portion of this. I'm a career educator, a career designer, and I have and enjoy an excellent client list. And I have really, really deep experience in this space. And that's how it began.
That is a cool story. There's so much there. I like that General Assembly kept telling you, no, you're like, you know what, I'll just do it myself then. And also I like that in your experience with GA, you kind of use that as like user research kind of for your Ask Like a Pro program. I don't think you didn't come into it with that intention, but in a way, you were able to use that as a foundation to create Ask Like a Pro. You also mentioned that you described yourself as a career designer. What is a career designer?
You know, I think that a big part of being a successful researcher or being successful today is about thinking creatively and thinking about problem spaces differently and using frameworks and different lenses to isolate different opportunities and extract them. As a designer, a career designer and researcher, one of the things that I've learned growing up, I should say, in my career, is how important that skill is, you know, to be able to look at things from different perspectives. And we create products and services for living. I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years. It's just been for other people. When it came time to, you know, really what I was hemming and hawing about was, you know, I know the risks associated with developing products and services, and I know how difficult it is, and I understand how challenging it is to remove the bias and iterate and the painstaking work that goes along with it. You know, was this something that I really wanted to bite off? And that was something I was evaluating. You know, it's different when you do it for yourself versus when you do it for someone that's paying you and hiring you, and you don't have as many stakes, you know, in the game.
Through Ask Like a Pro, you've trained and coached a lot of aspiring and current researchers, and also people who do research who aren't necessarily researchers per se, right? Over the past 10 years, what are some of the most common pain points these people have? So I know you had mentioned in one of our conversations offline that there are a few different use cases you've seen. So can you tell us more about those three different use cases?
The most common reasons I see people sign up for the courses or the series is they may have some gaps in their education. They may not have had any sort of formal education, or they may be focused on this type of research and not have had an opportunity to do that type of research. So I'd say filling in gaps is a really, really big one. Another is many people work alone or they're solo researchers on their team, and they're looking for community. They're looking for a place to share and to grow. They're looking for a place to communicate and gather ideas and share perspectives. Maybe they're looking for efficiencies, or they're looking for a different way to approach this or that, or they have a new stakeholder who's difficult, or they need to grow their team, or they're about to make their first hire. So I'd say the solo practitioner is one. Another use case is people who want to transition into the field. I see a lot of people coming from industry, and I see a lot of people coming from academia also. And there's very specific gaps that you have regarding, regardless of where you're transitioning from. You bring some historical and transferable knowledge, but there's other gaps in the way. So for instance, if you're transitioning from academia, you probably have a gap in our terminology, right? It's very difficult to understand the terms that we use, which was what led to the creation of the UX Lex, by the way. But other gaps might include anything usability related or anything related to heuristics. Also, the pace in which we work in industry is much faster, and how we communicate in industry. Often, the idea of working collaboratively and with a stakeholder, and the importance of stakeholder buy-in and teamwork and collaboration, is new to people coming from those areas. But if you're coming from, you know, the industry side, things like how to ask a good question, or why it's important not to ask leading questions, and what bias is and why it's important to mitigate it, and how bias can influence the feedback that we're gathering, and what happens when that feedback, you know, is corroded, and how to make better decisions. Those are things that academics tend to have an innate sense of, depending upon, you know, what they studied, of course. But if they're coming from an anthropology or a psychology part of the sciences, certainly they have an innate sense of that, whereas people from industry don't. So there are gaps to fill in a lot of different ways. I'd say the other use case is someone that has a very defined question set. So maybe it's a founder or an entrepreneur or CEO or product manager, or maybe even a designer. They have a specific question set they're looking to explore. They're not looking to transition into the industry per se, but they want to answer this question set. And the last, but certainly not least, are people who understand the power of research, and they want to understand it more broadly and more holistically, because if they feel that if they knew how to ask better questions, they would be able to make better decisions holistically in whatever career they're in or whatever relationship they're in. So just the sense of, if I know how to ask better questions, I'll be able to make better and more confident decisions in my life. So I would say those are the most typical use cases. And there, it's quite a range of people and beautiful minds. I mean, you have to have a, you know, a pretty spectacularly curious mind to want to take a deep dive into this subject matter. So working with all of these people is just, it's amazing to see their beautiful minds, you know, at play.
So my next question is, how do you ask a good question, right? Like, what are some of the parts of a good question? So for example, one of the parts is don't ask a leading question. Like, what else makes a good question?
You know, I teach like a whole module on this. And one of the best tips that I like to share is to practice asking open questions versus closed questions. So an open question will typically start with who, what, how, when, where, or why. And a closed question will typically start with do, did, was, were, or are. And the difference between an open-ended question and a closed-ended question is an open-ended question will reveal a far larger and more comprehensive response. A closed-ended question can typically be answered with one or two words like yes or no or yesterday. So the just becoming more aware of how you're asking your questions and if you're asking open-ended versus closed-ended questions is a really subtle change that can have a dramatic improvement on the quality of responses you're able to gather. And it doesn't even have to be just in a research situation. I mean, you can try this, you know, on the bus and at a dinner party and with your partner, just being aware of that very subtle difference and working to change that will really, really improve the quality of conversations you're able to have.
Going deeper with Ask Like a Pro, how can aspiring UX researchers build their confidence in portfolios?
So that's a great question. A lot of people, there's one adjective that is consistent across the people that are taking my courses. It's they want to take the courses to improve their confidence. They want to take the courses to either substantiate their existing learning or supplement, you know, those gaps that I mentioned earlier. But building confidence to me comes with learning by doing. And it comes with practicing, and it comes with rolling up your sleeve and really getting into it. The more experience you have doing with something, the more confident you will be in doing it. And that's why the Ask Like a Pro series is super hands-on. I teach the course so that people can learn by doing it, whether they're want to learn more about evaluative research or they want to learn more about generative research, whatever they're looking to learn more about, they're doing it and we're piloting it at every single step of the way. So the all-ins work with actual stakeholders so that they get that stakeholder experience. The stakeholders, you know, are going to throw some wrenches as they always do. The timeline's going to change, or the stakeholder is going to take another job in the middle of the project, and you have to learn to adapt and pivot and gather the feedback, and the show must go on. But they're also going to pilot. They're going to pilot at every step of the way. They're piloting their survey screeners. They're piloting their discussion guides and their activities. They're piloting their analysis and synthesis techniques. They are going to practice and pilot their presentations. I have like scorecards for them to evaluate how well they're doing in terms of their moderating and their facilitation skills, as well as their presenting skills. But I don't teach people, I don't give people answers. I teach people how to think. And then I also give them tools and templates and a whole lot of feedback on how they can maybe approach something differently or stronger or more efficiently or better. And that translates into a much greater confidence.
The best products are built by listening to your customers. But without a great tool, capturing quality insights is nearly impossible. D D-Scout was built to solve this challenge. Whether you're running moderated or unmoderated research, the D-Scout platform helps you recruit high-quality participants, manage unlimited concurrent studies, and share insights and video clips in minutes. Stop overpaying for questionable research. Instead, partner with D-Scout, the company trusted by Spotify, Lululemon, Google, and more. Visit dscout.com for all the tools you need to boost your insights program. That makes sense. And also, being a researcher, I know you and I have chatted about this. It's definitely about how you think. It's probably more so of a mindset than it is an occupation. Thinking in a very particular, specific way, right? Like you said, I love that you said you don't give your clients and Ask Like a Pro, your students, you don't give them the answers. You give them support to help enable them to think for themselves and think critically. So I do like that you made that distinction. And then in terms of your program, you've had UX research apprentices in the past. So what qualities did you look for when you were hiring these people?
I've hired several of my Ask Like a Pro students. And I look for people that have open minds. I look for people that are creative problem solvers. I look for people that can articulate their thoughts and their decisions, and people that are willing to take a chance, willing to make a mistake. I look for people that are really good communicators, and I'm evaluating, you know, them while we go through the course. I'm constantly saying to myself, could this person be good on this type of project, or could this person be helpful on that type of project? And, you know, I mentioned earlier, and I've written about this a few times on LinkedIn, I truly believe that everyone has a beautiful mind, and it's about appreciating and exploring and inspiring that person to share more of their beautiful mind and their perspective. So what I'm looking for are more beautiful minds. I'm looking for people who can think critically. Looking for people who can demonstrate that perspective consistently and bring something unique to the table and be proud of it.
Once someone gets their first UX researcher role after they're done with your program, there may be a bit of a culture shock for them, right? Like you said, when you're working with actual stakeholders, they may throw wrenches in your plan. They may leave to go to different companies. What are some surprises that these younger or more junior researchers have once they get on the job? And what advice do you have for them to help manage that transition?
I think one of the things that I hear most about is that how many meetings there are. And I do repeat quite frequently that UX is a team sport. And as a researcher, you won't be successful if you work individually, if you are a one-man team. It doesn't work like that, right? Like, my success is intrinsic to my team's success and vice versa. So the idea that it really is teamwork and there really are a lot of meetings and it really is very collaborative, I think is an aha. It's not that they haven't heard this from me. The realization of how it actually plays out is often eye-opening. Another is, especially during the pandemic, when you're starting at a company and you're starting remotely, that's really hard. It's really, really hard to build those relationships and build those connections. And you need to, as a researcher, one of the first things you need to do is build that trust and that credibility. And you have to earn that. And I have found that it's much harder to do that when we're working all remotely. And it really requires an extra effort, both on the researcher's part, as well as the home team's part, or the host team or the company. I think that those are two of the biggest surprises.
Yes, I can vouch for that. There are a lot of meetings in corporate America.
That's true. And another, I know, right? I got to go. I have a meeting. another surprise is how UX immature their company or culture may be. I just got off a call, the weekly call with my observers, and there was a ton of conversation about how do you handle a stakeholder who's telling you to do something that you know is incorrect? And how do you reply when someone tells you to do XYZ and you know it's not the right thing to do for whatever reason? And there's a lot of big ahas, I think, when people come out of the program and they're getting, you know, in their first positions, if they're not in a UX mature organization, about how immature the organization is. And that you know, it might not be the right fit for them long term. And that's okay too.
Yeah. And also another thing, once people actually get in the corporate world, a lot of researchers obviously are asked to share their research plans with stakeholders. And that may be a shock going from an environment where you're in a boot camp or in like some sort of course, as opposed to being in corporate America. Those are very different. So what are the most important parts of the research plan when you are working in the real world, so to speak, in corporate America or with a client as a consultant? What are the most important parts to include to appease your stakeholders in addition to you as a researcher?
So this is a really good question. And I was really floored to find out that there aren't any classes on research planning. And to me, it's the absolute foundation. It's the spinal cord of your success. The first class in the series is called Plan for that specific reason. And I would say the most important parts, I'm gonna interpret this a little differently. The most important aspects of the research plan are to get the team and the core stakeholders on the same page in terms of what are we looking to learn and how will the learnings be applied. That would be number one and number two. And then a fast follow to that would be, what level of confidence are we looking for and when do we need to make this decision? So in the research course, in the plan course that I teach, I have like a proprietary template, and it, you know, walks you through what information to put where and how to get this information and why this information is important. And we always want to make sure that whatever we are researching or whatever questions that we are exploring ties directly to our business goals. And what we want to do is ideally make the research goals everyone's goals, because we use that process of building the plan, which is iterative, right? That plan is going to be updated several times as key choices and decisions are made and as things unfold and as we learn more. We want to use that plan to establish and build that credibility. We want to use that plan to include our stakeholders and get them to invest in the outcome, right? We're using the process of building the plan to generate interest and buy-in in the research, because when we have them interested and bought in the research, they will be more included and more present, and they will be more invested in every stage of the process and more likely to implement on the outcomes. And ultimately, I mean, that's what our aim is for, right? Our aim is to move our teams from insights into action. So I would say the most important parts of the plan are to get that alignment with our stakeholders and to start to build that inclusivity and buy-in. We want to pay it forward.
And you touched on my next question. How do researchers connect our UX research projects to larger business objectives? That's something I know I struggle with and a lot of researchers do.
Yeah, so I think the easiest way, well, first of all, as a researcher, we should never be working on a project that isn't directly tied to our business goals. I mean, we work in support to, you know, either improve or understand or better the experience that we are designing for the people that we serve. So focusing your research efforts is tying your research efforts to your business goals, I have found, is most easily achieved by identifying the KPIs or the OKRs or whatever is culturally relevant in your organization to the research goals. So how does this question set relate to our KPIs or OKRs? And we want to ensure that it does indeed ladder up. If it doesn't, the chances that it will get acted upon are pretty slim to none, right? We want to ensure that not only does our question set ladder up to a very specific KPI or OKR, but we want to make sure that our stakeholders are also aligned in that same way. So again, it comes back to, what are we looking to learn? How will the learnings be applied? And again, those should support the business goals. So we're all working in unison. We are all working towards the same goalposts. And when we can tie it all together, then we're working together as a team, and our project will have more momentum. It will have more interest. It will have more buy-in, and the chances that the learnings will be acted upon just, you know, increase substantially.
And lastly, as we wrap this up, so you've had a lot of experience with researchers, aspiring researchers, people who do research at different career levels. How do UX researchers create a career path? How do they define the next step in their career? There isn't really one set path for UX researchers. There are many. So how do people actually begin to even create that for themselves?
You know, interestingly enough, I've spent a lot of time researching researchers. And one thing that's become clear and is also kind of curious is that most researchers don't seem to have a specific career goal. They're interested in the journey. They're interested in fueling their curiosity along the way. So I don't often meet someone that says, I want to become a research manager, or I want to become an independent researcher, or I want to be a staff researcher at a tech company. It's more about the career options in terms of learning. Like, I want to become, what I hear more often is, I want to learn how to facilitate better workshops. So I want to learn how to incorporate more exciting activities into my live interviews. I want to learn how to, just like you said, everybody's path is different, but I found it's often not about achieving a specific goal. Maybe it's to transition from academia into applied research. You know, maybe that's the goal, but it's not about a goal to be at this level or that level. It's more about an analysis of their own skill sets and wanting to improve a specific capability and learn more about that. I see more of that than a career goal, if you will. Now, many junior researchers want to find their first job, and many senior researchers are less inclined to look for, you know, a specific job. You know, everyone's moving, but it's more about the need or the desire to keep learning, to keep improving. I don't know many researchers who no longer practice research. Do you?
I can't think of any. I feel like being a researcher is almost like a personality trait, right? Like, it's like in our DNA. We can't never stop doing it.
You know what? I absolutely agree with that. It's the mindset. And that's why I think it translates into this kind of lack of career goal. And by the way, I don't say this like with any judgment. I say this because I agree with you. I think it's a mindset, and it's more about the journey than the destination.
Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, YZZI research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.